His dad took the hose and froze the backyard. Little buddy dreamed he was Rocket Richard.
Back on downtown. Carrie picked that one for you, Bruce.
That's great. There's a wonderful story called The Hockey Sweater or The Chandail de Hockey, written by a guy named Roquerier, which is about a group of kids who all wear number 9 because they want to be Maurice Richard. And one of them's mother orders him a new jersey, and it turns out to be a Toronto Maple Leafs jersey. The kid is absolutely destroyed. It's one of the great, one of the really, really great hockey books of all time. It's a very short little book, but it's great. Yeah, we all wanted to be a Richard when I was a kid.
Sportslit 101 here on this Wednesday afternoon, and part two of our conversation about a terrific book. Set that up again and fill us in on it, if you could, Bruce.
Yeah, this is about the 1932 World Series, which one might argue, you know, every World Series is important, but it was really a transition point in baseball. By this point in time, Rogers Hornsby has been fired as the manager of the Cubs by Bill Veeck Sr. Charlie Grimm has taken over. The Cubs and the Pirates and everybody in the league except the Reds have fought down to the end. The Cubs are in the World Series. They're facing the Yankees, who, after 3 years in a row of domination by the Philadelphia Athletics, crushed the field and, you know, clinched the pennant, I don't know, late August or something. And this will be the only World Series in which Babe Ruth will appear, or the only time Babe Ruth will appear in Wrigley Field, because when he pitched for the Red Sox in the 1918 World Series, the games were at Comiskey Park because it held more people. This time around in 1932, bleachers were set up that went over the back of the famed Ivy Walls all around Wrigley, so they could fit 18,000 more than fit in there now. It was a big deal for a couple of reasons. One, we're in the middle of the Depression. We know that we were about to see the end of Prohibition. I mean, for all intents and purposes, it's over, but you know, it's not legally over. And we must remember that all the presidents during the wars wanted baseball to continue because they felt it was very important. As we've talked and you talked about with the author of The Big Fella the other day, Ruth at this point is a giant. He's getting near the end of his career, but he's a giant. He's a celebrity of the highest order, yet he has a very common touch. He'll hang out with people, hang out with crowds. And he was vilified by people who hated the Yankees, but still adored by a lot of people who just might not even have been Yankee fans. So what happens is that some of the people in the stands at this game are the Roosevelts, Franklin and Eleanor. He will be elected in November to his first term. Bill Bojangles Robinson, who traveled with the Yankees all the time, the famed entertainer. Al Capone will be in the stands. John Dillinger is in the stands for this game. Kennesaw Mountain Landis is there with his nephews, a person who will go on to great acclaim, become known as somebody other than Johnny Stevens. Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens was at the game. Listening on the radio in Brooklyn is a young 18-year-old by the name of Bernard Malamud, who will get the idea for a book which, in baseball fiction, I would say The Natural has to rank up there in the top three on almost anyone's list. And the Cubs really feel that by coming home and having their veteran Charlie Root pitching the game, that the 1932 World Series is going to be extended. So they're all psyched. The place is packed. The booze is flowing. The gambling is going on in the stands. There are 50,000 people in Wrigley. And in the first inning, normally very adept shortstop Billy Jurgis, who we knew from last week was shot by Violet Popovich earlier in the year, muffs his first chance at shortstop, throws over the head of the first baseman. The next Root watts the next man. There are men at first and second, and up comes Babe Ruth, and people are throwing oranges and lemons at him. People are yelling racial slurs, indicating that he has some non-Caucasian blood in him. It's nasty. He makes a mistake, and Ruth puts it out over everybody in right field, and suddenly it's 3-0. And, you know, it doesn't look really good. But the Cubs come back in the top of the fourth. The Yankees go up 4-3. Kai Kyler is able to tie it up. And so in the fifth, it was tied at four. So now Ruth is coming up in the batter's box with Gehrig on deck. And as soon as he gets up, the catcalls and everything go crazy. Now, there are two people at this game whose names are lost in a sense to history, but very important. One is Matt Candle, K-A-N-D-L-E. The other is Harold Warp. And Harold and Matt brought 16-millimeter cameras to the game to film what they thought would be the important moments. In those days, you couldn't film an entire baseball game without changing you had to keep changing batteries and film and all that. So Ruth's next at bat, he's facing Charlie Root still, and the count is 2 balls and 2 strikes. Ruth, when he's being yelled at, is shouting back at the other team, and he's pointing different places all the time with his bat. This is where the question, did he call the shot? Because he will hit a titanic home run exactly where it was the last place he pointed his bat. But Ruth had a habit of pointing his bat before he put it on his shoulder anyway. But what happened was it was a 2-2 pitch, and Ruth was sure that Ruth would be thinking 2-2 fastball, but Ruth was guessing curveball. Ruth threw a curveball, and the home run went out in the very absolutely deepest point of the park. Now, a lot of people were thinking, okay, Ruth called the shot. But here's the interesting thing. None of the broadcasters said anything about it at the time. And when the Yankees ended up winning 7-5, the Cubs were now down 3-0. There were some people that asked some of the broadcasters and some of the journalists what they saw. And it seems to depend on where you sat in the ballpark. If you sat on the Cubs third base side, you tended to think that he did not point to the home run. And Charlie Root didn't think he did. People sitting on the Yankees side or the right field side thought that he did. Of course, that sort of makes sense. But what's really interesting is, as we talked about last week, Ruth hit 3 home runs in one of his very last major league games at Forbes Field in Pittsburgh when he was playing out a string for the Boston Braves. The last home run went over the wall in Forbes Field, out of the stadium, which had never happened before. And there are many people who think that Charlie Root grooved that pitch. But Ruth clearly pointed to right field that time. So in one time he called a shot. The other time we don't know. And the problem is the video is really inconclusive. And it might have been more conclusive if it had come to light that this video existed. But these were just kept by these two guys and their family. They didn't know the importance of it. One of them was only verified in October of 1980.
Wow.
But
wow.
Candle died in 1951. And basically, these films have been shown at family reunions and the like. But to give you an idea of the quality of the players, 10 New York Yankees go on to the Hall of Fame. Ruth, Gehrig, Lazeri, Sewell, Dickey, Coombs, Gomez, Ruffing, Herb Pennock, and manager Joe McCarthy. As would Ed Barrow, as the general manager who had built the Red Sox when Ruth was there and then came to work for Colonel Rupert and built the Yankees. Now, here's another little interesting piece. But who were the people from the Chicago Cubs? Kaikai Kyler hit over 310 times. Gabby Hartnett, a 297 hitter, an MVP award winner, managed the Cubs later, elected to the Hall of Fame, as was Kyler. Billy Herman, elected to the Hall of Fame. Burley Grimes, elected to the Hall of Fame. Rogers Hornsby, who was the manager for a good portion of the year and had played in some of the Cubs games. Woody English, the interesting thing about him was he came out of retirement to coach the Grand Rapids Chicks of the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League in the 50s, and he came up in the book about Isabel Alvarez. Billy Jurgis, you know, the guy who was shot. The pitching staff was Guy Bush, Charlie Root, Pat Malone, and Lauren Warnke. Together, they won 704 major league games over their career. So this was really a clash of really, really good baseball teams. It's the ascendancy of Gehrig. It's the near the demise of Ruth. It's after the end of Hornsby's career. So the 1932 really is a year in which baseball really meant something to the United States. These games were followed incredibly rapidly on radio. Of course, there were no TV broadcasts in 32, but radio and in newspapers and people lining up at teletype offices. And this book, The Called Shot, really brings this to life in a way. It's written, it very much reminds me of the book we talked about Monday and the way it's written. Wolf wrote this very much the way Nathanson wrote the book. Where there was speculation, it was clear it was speculation. Where it was fact, it's fact. It's a really, really good book.
Excellent. Well, it sounds great. Good fun talking about it the last couple of weeks, and I look forward to reading it myself. What do we have next week on Sports Lit?
Well, I'm looking at three books right now, and I don't know exactly which one we'll get. There's one from the Society of American Baseball Research called The Great Eight, which is about the 75 Cincinnati Reds. And it takes what they think of the eight most important players and their short biographies of each of them and some stats. I'm reading a book called National Pastimes by a woman named Katharina Bonzel called Cinema, Sports, and Nation. I'm not sure about this one because it's a little bit on the college professor side, but I haven't read enough into it. And then a fabulous but very big book that'll keep me busy by Peter Joffrey Nye called Hearts of Lions, A History of American Bicycle Racing, which is really good. I've read the first chapter of each of these books, and they're quite good. So it'll be one of them, but I think what I may do, since they're all fairly lengthy books, is what I might do is take a look at all kinds of baseball fiction people probably don't know, because it could be a while before we have baseball, and maybe do a little presentation on books like the Dixie Association, the World's Greatest Slump, some other really good baseball books that we've not talked about before and aren't new but are still very good.
That sounds great. Awesome, Bruce. Thank you.
You are welcome, sir.
Sports Lit 101 every Wednesday here on Downtown.